Welcome to Knights of Roleplay, an adventuring podcast. This is an actual play Dungeons & Dragons podcast. Royalty-free music provided by Kevin MacLeod, Michael Gelfie Studios, Plate Mill Games, and Tabletop Audio. And now, to adventure. Hello, listeners. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Knights of Roleplay. I'm DM Chris, and this is Session Zero for my upcoming homebrew campaign called Dragon Birth, which is set in my homebrew campaign setting called Harkonrath. In this session, we will be talking about a variety of topics regarding the campaign. If we have time, we'll do a very short adventure. The topics we'll be covering are as follows. Campaign essentials, campaign length, streamlining combat encounters, character creation, magic items, game rules, table rules, playing a person down, safety tools, and further development. So, starting with campaign essentials, give printed versions of the campaign one sheet. So I created a campaign one sheet that I shared in Google Docs with everybody, but I'm going to give out a printed copy anyway. So for the benefit of the players, it basically just gives kind of a rundown of the basics of the campaign, some stuff about character creation, a little bit about safety tools. So I'm just going to pass this out to everyone. Although, again, they have access to it in our shared Google Docs.
Safety tools. Does that include safe words?
You know, you could have saved a tree. Jesus, Chris.
Okay. So I handed out the campaign one sheet.
It's right. Going to kill me already.
No. Saving a digital tree is not saving an actual tree.
So the concept of this campaign. This campaign takes place in my homebrew setting called Harkonrath on the island continent of Iador, which is ruled over by the dragonborn species and overseen by five chromatic dragons, white, blue, black, red, and green. By homebrew, I mean I created the overall campaign setting, but I may use material from a variety of published products and place that material into my homebrew setting, in which case I will give credit to whoever it is that that I appropriated that from or inspired, whatever that is. The campaign pitch is to end the rule of the Dragonborn Council. The in-game tone is serious, and the six truths of the world are... number one, the Dragonborn Council is corrupt, but many other Dragonborn are not. The Dragonborn Council uses the threat of the five chromatic dragons to maintain their position. The chromatic dragons each reside in their own region of Iador, with the populace of each region living under their watchful eyes. The tribute makes life hard for the populace. The tribute is 20% of all earnings of all businesses and 10% of all wages earned by workers, collected at the end of every month and split between the council and the dragon's hordes. Item five, the fifth truth, is civil unrest is increasing, and the sixth truth is riots are becoming more common. So are there any questions about these campaign essentials that I just went through? Any questions at all?
Did you just say this is a serious campaign?
The in-game tone is serious.
That's it, I quit. I can't do this.
I fully expect immature behavior and randomness from my friends.
That's probably a good idea, because Chaos Gremlin is tattooed across my whole dimension.
Drunken Master Monk.
Well, I mean, every campaign we have has an in-game tone of being serious.
There's a serious goal or something at stake. Right.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Totally.
Seriously?
How active in the world are the actual chromatic dragons? Are they just like a presence?
Do they just stay in their little cave?
Or do they actually come out and burn villages or whatever it is they do to enact the will of the council?
They are largely they kind of stay to themselves for the most part. You know, it's rare that people will see one of the dragons flying through the sky in whatever region they happen to be in. You know, like the white dragon from White Province, for example. You know, you may see it flying around every so often. But yeah, they don't really do a whole lot as far as you know. There's just sort of this ever-present threat. You see them once in a while on, like, extreme rare occasions throughout history. If there was some sort of a large threat to a region and it caught the attention of that particular dragon, it would do something about it. But that hasn't happened in quite a while, and typically people just kind of live somewhat in fear of what might happen.
So it's like happen. The head of the mob family that's only ever spoken about in whispers.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
And occasionally seen flying through the sky.
Yeah.
Okay,
so it's not something where they're just words. They actually do exist.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, people see them every so often, and throughout history they have made their presence known. They are real. They are exist. They do exist.
They do exist.
I are existing.
They are real. Yes.
Definitely real. Yeah.
To that note, dragons have long lives. I know it's been like 3,000 years since they came to be. Are these the same dragons that were original? Or are they descendants?
Stop poking at his plot hole, Sarah.
No.
That's not a plot hole.
I think it's a really cool question. I would say that the majority of the populace of Iador is not really sure.
Okay.
There may be some...
They're that mysterious that we wouldn't know.
You could probably do a lot of digging to try to find out.
Okay.
But most people just kind of go about their lives being like, yeah, there's dragons.
Okay.
Yeah, you're not exactly sure. I would probably say that most people assume that the dragons that are ruling over the different regions of Iador, that they've been around since the beginning of dragons. Most people make that assumption, but nobody
really
has confirmed that.
Yeah. It's less important who the dragons are and more important that there are dragons, essentially, right?
Yeah.
How old do turtles really get to be?
Any other questions about that sort of campaign essential stuff?
How prominent are the civil unrest situations? Like, is it where there's people always fighting in the streets, or is it something where in going through your daily situations that occasionally you'll see, you know, people running around looting or what have you?
I would say that the day-to-day lives of people on the continent of Iador is pretty normal. You know, there's just kind of like this Cold War tension that just kind of exists all the time between the chromatic dragons and the populace. And if people just kind of like, you know, do their daily jobs and don't make anybody angry or upset, things are fine. But
there's an air of, like, if somebody steps too far out of line, anything could happen at any time.
Correct. And you hear about it more so than you see it, right? Is that kind of...
No, I would say that riots have become more common in recent years.
Okay.
And the Dragonborn that used to patrol, like, in pairs, are patrolling groups of six now. Mm-hmm. And I would probably say, like, if I had to maybe put an average on it, I would say maybe, like, once every few months or so, there's some sort of a major problem where you get like a group of people that are just so fed up with the council and the tribute that there's some kind of a conflict between the Dower Guard, who are the Dragonborn that kind of patrol around the city and stuff like that, and there's some kind of like a big riot, you know, and then they're called in sometimes to try to quell the riot, sometimes. They are part of the riot. It depends on what it is. You know, I'd probably say once every 4 months or so, there's some kind of major drama somewhere in Iador that involves some kind of a riot. And people
write that down. If 4 months goes by without a riot, we need to figure out what's going on.
Cause a riot.
No, we need to cause a riot.
Start a riot. Okay, got it.
You know, but it used to be like many many years ago, like hundreds and hundreds of years ago, there were no riots. People just were like so afraid, so afraid of the Dragonborn Council calling down the dragons that people would just kind of stayed in line. Mm. But after centuries and centuries and centuries of the tribute and feeling in fear of the dragons, people are just starting to get fed up, and there are more and more riots happening in recent centuries. But I mean, you know, I mean, you could go months at a time and just everything is just kind of fine. So let that, there's like that tension in the background. People just kind of go about their business, trying not to make the Dragonborn Council upset. Mm-hmm. But most people get along fine as long as you kind of stay in line and obey the laws.
Are there like public executions and stuff?
No. No. There's no public executions now. No. No. I mean, sometimes the when the Dower Guard get called in and there's a problem, people like get thrown in jail. Occasionally people aren't seen again, but typically people just are in jail for a very long time and people are released. People don't just like get in trouble and disappear forever. It just happens every so often that it's like somebody is never seen from again, but mostly people just get thrown in jail and they spend a lot of time in jail and then they're released and everything's fine. Occasionally when they have the riots, people get killed and nobody really does anything about it because it's the Dragonborn Council, so they just kind of move on. So I mean, again, all the more reason people historically have tried not to get I've tried not to come into conflict with the Dragonborn Council.
Out of sight.
But they're just getting so sick and tired of it.
Out of mind.
In recent years. They're like, somebody's got to do something.
Okay.
Anything else?
Okay.
For now, I think.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, we still got a lot of stuff to cover, and we got lots of time. So the my second item here is the campaign length. I'm estimating this campaign will last about a year. I mean, that's just a rough estimate. I would like to provide opportunities for other DMs to run games, which we've been doing with Tomb and Tomb of Annihilation and Candlekeep and Greg's.
Because DM Chris needs a break every now and then.
Yeah, I want a break. I mean, I love running, but would like to have like a break. So,
yeah.
So in that regard, I'm going to kind of alternate back and forth between running homebrewed, sort of more story focused campaigns. Like I'm giving you guys kind of like an objective at the beginning of this, which I haven't done in the past. This is the first time I've ever in my career been like, this is kind of like the general idea of the campaign. This is kind of the general goal.
Chris is railroading us already when you haven't even started.
I mean, it always ends up that there's some obvious big direction, right?
Eventually.
It shows up later.
Yeah, but I usually don't like put it out there at the beginning of the campaign.
In this case, the world building has made it blatant that there's an issue, right?
So. Right. So basically, what my hope is that I'll run like
violence and tyranny inherent in the system.
Whereas Spacefarers went 2 years and 8 months, I'm like, I'd like to maybe run for about a year, let somebody run something, and then I'll run another campaign, and then let somebody run something. We'll kind of alternate back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So with regard to my more story-focused, somewhat shorter campaigns, character backgrounds may be a little harder to incorporate, whereas like I had all this time with Spacefarers to get like all your backstories included in there in some way. It may be a little bit harder with the shorter story-focused campaigns, but I would like you to still make backstories, because number one, it helps with your role play and your character design.
That is already done.
But you are not obligated to do that.
I keyed. You know I like a backstory.
And one thing which I would like all of you to do is during the first actual adventure, I'm going to ask everyone to narrate a flashback of their character during a pivotal moment in their character's life. I mean, this can be anything that you want. You're just going to be like, okay, so when my character was this age, this really important thing happened that set me on the path of doing this. It doesn't necessarily have to do with, like, the rule of the Dragonborn or the Chromatic Dragons. You know, it can be just something that made you decide to be an adventurer, something that made you decide to be, you know, that's when I decided to be a warlock, or whatever it is. I just kind of want to have you guys come up with a flashback that talks about some important moment in your character's life. And it can be about anything that you want it to be about. I just think it'll be fun to have you guys narrate a little bit about a pivotal moment in your character's life.
That could be interesting, because I'm playing the most vanilla character.
I mean, if somebody really feels super uncomfortable, I'm not going to force you to do that.
No.
But it would be nice.
I think it's cool.
And then at the end of the campaign, what I'll probably do is I'll have what's called 1 year later, where when we're doing the last session, I'll ask each of you what your character does over the course of, like, the next year.
Mm.
You can just kind of make it up. I mean, we did that at the end of Spacefarers. People talked about what they thought the character was doing. It's basically just the same thing.
bold of you to assume we'll survive.
I mean, definitely.
If your character is still alive.
In memoriam for old characters, too. Yeah.
Are you all standing at my grave? Do you come to visit? That's a good question.
So let's see. I think that's...
Is it in Strawberry Fields?
Forever.
That is my number two item, which was campaign length. Is there any questions about the shorter story-focused campaigns or about narrating pivotal moment in your life or 1 year later at the end of the campaign? Anything? Any concerns? Any questions?
Pivot.
I did actually do that in my backstory. Actually,
you pivoted?
Yeah, I mean, if you wrote a backstory and you want to pull something out of it and just tell me about it as your pivotal moment, that's perfectly fine. So we're good on that stuff?
I'm good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So my third item here is streamlining combat encounters. This is just a personal thing of mine that I wanted to try out. So, you know, we typically get about approximately 2 hours of actual playtime out of our, like, three-hour sessions. I'd like to try to get just a little bit more out of that by streamlining combat. So I'm going to implement these following rules, and I may make modifications to these rules over time as I see how well they do or don't work. You know, and I always welcome feedback or suggestions if we get partway through the campaign and we're like,
Chris, you know, is on the Dragonborn Council.
This thing.
He's a dragon.
He's already rolled.
He's the black dragon, isn't he? He's actually Tiamat.
Let's see. So with regard to streamlining combat encounters, combat encounters go faster with low-level characters. So characters for this campaign will start at first level and go to second level after the first full-length adventure. Then characters will gain a level every three adventures, which is something which we've done in the past. We're going to stick with that.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Theater of the Mind combat is faster than using maps and miniatures, but I like using minis.
Me too. Me too.
I'll mostly be using maps and minis. I may use Theater of the Mind for some minor combat encounters to save time. Mm-hmm. We'll be using average hit points for characters and monsters. So characters will simply get the average hit die for their level.
Okay, so we won't be rolling hit dice.
Won't be rolling hit dice.
Okay.
No, you're just going to get whatever the average is, and except that at first level you get maximum hit points.
Yeah.
As per our usual. And you still get other hit point buffs, such as, you know, Constitution or the Tough Feat or things like that. Sometimes I may choose to use average monster damage, which would be doubled for criticals. So if you hear me calling out the same damage number over and over again, it's because I'm just avoiding rolling, mm-hmm. and I'm just using the average damage. And if they critical, I'll just double the average damage.
Yeah, I think I did that a couple of sometimes on the Curse of Strahd campaign, mm-hmm. and it worked out fairly well, especially on the combats that I just like. You guys are going to just blast through this, and let's just do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And move on.
Yeah.
Or if there's, like, mobs and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Large numbers of creatures, just go average works really well.
There is a variety of reasons why I may use that. So I'll take that as a case-by-case basis.
Okay.
So let's see, blah, blah, blah. So characters will still roll for damage. I thought about having people just do the average damage, but I'm not going to... Rolling is half the fun, so I'm gonna let you guys.
Give us our math rocks.
Yeah, I want to clickety clack my math rocks.
But please do me a favor and please roll. A lot of you do this already, but please roll your attack dice and your damage dice together. It's a minor thing, but it can save some time. For critical hits for players, this is a little bit of a change. We're simply going to be multiplying the damage by two. So you're still going to roll damage regularly, but like if you crit, you know, you roll it, you're like, I got a crit. You add up the dice that you just rolled and just multiply it by two.
Okay. So don't roll additional dice.
Don't roll additional dice. No.
I don't think it's going to be relevant for any of what people are planning to play, but like feats that let you like reroll runs, ones and twos, I assume you do all the rerolls on your base damage and then double from that.
If you have feats and stuff, or class features that let you reroll, I'm not going to say you can't use your class feature.
Okay,
good. Yeah. Because I do have a class feature that lets
all
me
reroll. All right, what's relevant? Yeah.
Well, you think you do. You might change your mind at the end of this session.
I might.
Yeah, because halflings come with luck. If I roll a one on an attack roll, I can
derailing roll. Already.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely.
Fire powers combined. Squirrel.
So
put the two squirrels on this side.
Might need to separate squirrels.
Maybe.
I mean, he's a squirrel too.
Yeah, sorry. You're
so if you put him next to me, you're also in bad shape. What?
What?
I am not a squirrel.
I have three ADHD players.
He has what? Three ADHD players of Greg.
That just makes me sound like Greg.
Guess that makes you the responsible
one. You are the
one.
Hottest player at this table.
I'm flaming myself.
I'll take your word for it.
So we will not be using flanking. But later in the session, though, we're going to discuss some alternative ideas for gaining advantage both in and out of combat. I have a couple of different ideas to use. So the more creatures a player controls, the more turns they have during combat, as I discovered during the Battle Royale.
I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, totally slowed down the battle right now.
I was sitting right there when that happened, and I was like, what the fuck? What are you doing to me, Chris?
Which that is a two episode
Battle Royale
and the earlier episodes of our catalog. If you want to listen to that. So if you're playing a character that can summon, you can only summon and or control one creature. And they have average hit points from their stat block. The summon spells in Tasha's Cauldron of Everything are specifically designed to summon one creature. Mm-hmm. So those are a good option. The one exception to this rule would be like, you could control two creatures if your class gives you a creature to control, like if you're an artificer and you have a steel defender or something like that. But you also want to summon something. I wouldn't say no to that, but I would beg and plead for you to please be efficient when you take your three turns in combat. But I'd rather have people that have familiars or summoning creatures to just be controlling one other creature.
I just realized if our lineup doesn't change, we're going to be very caster light.
It might be a non-issue the way things are shaping up right now.
No, I mean, no one may have anything to do with
summoning
or familiars or companions.
But that's
good to have it out there,
just in case you know,
somebody may die and we have to replace the character.
I volunteer as tribute.
So I will not be using the initiative board.
Oh,
which for our listeners, this is something that we would set up behind me. So people could see the initiative.
Sad face.
And I will be asking for a campaign volunteer to collect initiative while I set up for the encounter. So while I'm putting the maps and the miniatures out, I'm going to have someone else.
She's the one that always has the notes. collect
initiatives and then hand
it to
me.
I thought we were talking about potentially having another player run the initiative board so we could still get it for like the squirrel brains so we could look at it if we didn't get it all written down.
No, I think it's good for the squirrel brains to have to remember things.
So
it's good to flex.
I think it's asking a lot for the squirrel brains to have to remember things.
I know. I'm one of them.
I mean, I'm just, if it ends up that we play a little bit and it's rocky, I'm okay with like running.
You know what? If
it
helps me actually remember to take notes and remember things, I will volunteer to run the initiative. Someone remind me that I just volunteered to run the initiative.
Don't let our listeners call you out.
Oh, I'll let our listeners call you out. Terry? You have permission to message me and call me out.
When I decided to do this in here to save time, I assumed that you would be the one who would volunteer.
Did you really?
I did.
Nice.
I said it's probably going to be Sarah.
We don't know each other very well.
We don't know each other at all. 20 years of friendship doesn't do that. Oh my god!
And I will tell you, it wasn't going to be me.
And I'll be using static initiative for monsters. They will always go on initiative count 13.
Oh.
So,
Lucky.
Or unlucky.
Weights things a little in your favor.
Not necessarily. It's pretty much right in the middle.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about dex bonuses. Never mind.
Yeah.
So
does that mean if there's multiple different monsters, they're all going to go in the same...
Most likely, I will have like every single enemy go on a 13.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's going to be different to get used to. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's basically a variation of side initiative.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At that point.
Mm-hmm. You know, and obviously, I mean, I love you guys. I trust you guys. Please don't try to exploit this rule. Like, oh, I know they're always going to go on 13. So right. What can I do to break this? Like, mm-hmm. Please don't do that.
Is there source book content that you're using that provided that guidance? Source book content, is this a lazy DM tip and trick that you're implementing or something in that flavor? Or?
I heard about this particular flavor from Mike Shea from Slot Flourish, okay. Yes. Cool. He's not the only person that does okay. That kind of a thing.
All right, cool.
But that's where I heard it from, yes.
Nice. Shout out.
Yeah.
Did you just now respond to my comment?
What's that?
We're looking at you, Medicator.
Oh, yeah.
No.
I only rolled a Dex 12, but I've got or Initiative 12, but I've got an inspiration, so I can try again.
Yeah. We love you.
Love you
too. This monk is more straightforward.
Yeah, monk already has
Drunken
like a plus
master
15
is pretty
initiative
yeah,
anyway.
It's not the kind of cheese. That
it's just
has.
Something to save the DM time.
Yeah. Kane is not going first on every round, per usual.
Per usual.
I mean, if you don't have some sort of amazing dexterity modifier that gives you a 20 something on every initiative roll, I have a heart attack.
Kate does historically build dex-based characters.
Yes. That is her flavor of choice.
Strength on other occasions. I do prefer minis, dex.
That is her weapon of choice.
I'm thinking I just might not buy one if we're not going to use them, really.
He said he's going to use them for major
I'm going to use minis most of the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
But for minor encounters that really don't matter quite as much, I might just use theory.
Like the lightweight, easy encounters in an adventure, as opposed to the big, heavy encounter in an adventure.
A bunch of wolves attack us. And,
yeah, I like using minis.
Yeah.
So, and I like using maps. I have like 22 of Loki battle map books, and I like using those.
If you want a mini Greg once you have,
I have
picked, I'll work
two or three
you
of them now.
Good. Because I'm happy to paint and assemble. We'll see how quick it happens. But
okay.
I need that crafty time.
I can always like
life.
Grab
I've
a selection
it.
Of minis from my minis, Greg, and you can pick one if you want, rather than having to go to Hero Forge. As much as we love Hero Forge, you don't have to go there and do all that kind of stuff.
We will take all the sponsors.
Every last one of them. Every last one.
Are there any questions about that sort of streamlining combat stuff?
No.
No.
I think it's going to take, it'll be interesting to get used to, I think.
Yeah.
No, flanking. I think we did that for John's, for Tomb of Annihilation, too, right? We didn't do flanking
there. I think
so
that's because everything was theater of the mind.
Yeah, I mean, we've been getting used to it in a sense anyway for that reason.
Everything on Zoom, we never had flanking on Zoom.
That's true, because that was also all theater of the mind.
With the rogue in the party, flanking made it way too easy to get sneak attacks in anyway.
Yeah, spike damage for a rogue. Like, I mean, I'm really curious to see how a rogue would function when there's no flanking. Because flanking is an optional rule in 5th edition. So it's like, so instead of the rogue sneak attacking like almost every single turn, maybe that's just spiking their damage way
higher. There are different ways.
There are.
Depending on how you build your rogue, there are many different ways.
If you do swashbuckler, there's a lot of built-in tools.
And the party can, and having a good party
So maybe choosing a rogue is a good idea for me, because I can demonstrate the different types of ways to build a rogue.
Caster flavors of rogues with invisibility, for example.
I can't tell you how many times we've gotten to a fight, and the minis are all in one big line, because everybody's flanking. And it would just like, that's what would happen almost every time. People would just keep everybody get in a line. Okay, next combat, everybody get into a line.
Yeah.
I'd like to see how things are mixed up. Like, I played a shield fighter, and it was like, if somebody within 5 feet of you gets attacked, you can interpose your shield. And then when I tried to play it, I was giving up flanking on the possible chance of being able to have one of my allies,
get in there, and
I'm like, but I want to flank, but I want to use my shield thing, and they contradicted each other, so that's because flanking was a thing. So we'll try it and see how it goes.
Yeah, I've played with other groups that don't do flanking, and it's actually quite nice.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We'll see how it goes.
Encounter balance is harder when you have that there. That's definitely
it makes it more realistic, actually, in my experience.
So my fourth item here is character creation. We're not going to make characters right at this point, but I want to go over some of the basics, which I've given you guys in the Dragon Birth one sheet. So I created 3 new playable races. Gargoyles are winged humanoids with beaks, claws, and leathery wings, who can turn themselves to stone. Root folk are sentient tree creatures who can extend their limbs. I am Root. Shardlings are sentient constructs made from hard crystal who can refract light in many ways. People are going to have first level characters. First level characters, point buy for abilities, maximum hit points at first level. Knacks are a house rule that I'm using for this campaign. At first level, your character has a knack with a specific skill. Choose a skill that your character is proficient in for your knack. You gain a +5 static bonus to that skill, and you can treat a d20 roll of 9 or lower as a 10. So you will have a knack in one of your skills that you are proficient in.
And if you bork it, it's always a 10 or higher.
Yeah. I don't want people to be able to bork their knack.
Yeah. Like, I have a knack for performance. I'm always going to be at least a 10.
it's a light version of expertise.
So the following subclasses are not allowed. Peace Cleric and Twilight Cleric.
Oh, wow.
What? Encounter Bells?
What?
No.
Chris found out how busted Twilight Cleric really
knew.
Is.
When I told him I was playing for Greg's, he already knew and told me he wasn't going to allow it. Yeah. Twilight Cleric, that combat buff with the Twilight Aura that gives everybody temporary hit points every round.
The reason everybody's
part of why we cheesed your combat so heavily is because of that buff.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah, at the end of our turns, we're reading 7 temporary hit points in your thing, and it's basically jacking up our hit point totals, like, you know, by
an entire level.
Yeah,
massive plus some for some of us.
More than that, because basically you get that 7 back every turn.
Not to mention sharing 300-foot dark vision.
No wonder I couldn't kill you.
Party, right? That actually would have been exceptional for Tomb of Annihilation with the dark vision skill.
Yeah.
Any questions about that list of stuff?
So how are the gnats, how are they, or is that something you're going to have to keep track of?
You're going to have to keep track of it on your own, yeah.
There's ways to manually set that in D&D Beyond, though. So, like, you can pick one of the skills that you're proficient in, and I think you tap on it and, like, customize and add, like, a custom bonus or something to it. I think there is a way to do that, so it's not as much.
There's two on here that you didn't mention, the monk and the silvery barbs.
Correct, yes.
Okay. What's silvery barbs? I forget.
Yeah, I didn't know.
That's actually a spell that bards use a lot.
It's a bard spell.
It's a bard spell.
Yeah, I'm gonna.
And it's actually really busted. I've used it.
I'm gonna cover that under the game rules section.
Oh, okay.
But,
sorry.
No, it is relevant to character creation, so I understand.
Okay.
But I will cover that.
No, it's like the monk one. We're gonna talk about it later. But Chris already reviewed that with me when I said I was thinking about a monk, and I was like, I'm fine with that house rule. That's okay.
Yeah. So my next section here is magic items. Magic items will be very rare, and you won't usually find them in shops. The rules for crafting magic items are not allowed, but artificers can create magic items given to them from their class features. Potions of healing can still be bought at some apothecaries and shops, but in relatively small quantities. Even knowing all that info, I'd still like each player to give me a magic item wish list with one or two items on it, and I will try to work them into the game. Like when I was going up...
AF. In my notes.
Love wish spell.
I think Strax gave Chris PTSD with all these strange things.
It's just like I have fond memories of being a teenager and playing D&D, and when my character got a magic item, it was like,
wondrous thing of all.
It was so cool.
I would like to add dress with pockets to my...
Yeah, absolutely.
Magic item list.
Yeah, I mean, give me a wish list, and I will try to find a way to work it into the campaign.
I don't know if you... did I actually post that to our
channel?
I don't
remember. We've shared it on the D&D Facebook.
I know I've shared it before, but I recently came across it again. I'll send you the PDF.
Sure. Yeah, sure. any questions with regards to magic items?
So, in other words, don't expect to get one.
I mean, no, expect them to be rare.
I mean, it's just like
or like rare item drops in dungeons and shit.
Yeah, when we did Spacefarers, you know, like the Rock of Brawl was this hub, and you could like buy magic items like just right on the rock and in the center of the campaign. But it's also
like the center of wild space, like things come there.
Right, and Strax was doing making magic items and things,
item creation rules
and stuff like that. So I wanted to have more of that air of. of excitement and mystery and rarity.
Sure. Yeah, I'm assuming that you'll handle when we get high enough in level that most things are going to be resistant to anything except magic damage type stuff.
I feel like...
Right, and I don't want to do that and have you guys not have any magic items that can...
We've been scaling back from, like, Points of Light was probably the most egregious. Like, you had a lot of fun giving us magic items starting very early on.
Yeah.
The power creep that happened as a result.
Imagine that. Something based on magic. The Gathering had magic items.
No, it was the Points of Light campaign. So but it was like a god level. You guys were going to fight Vecna at the end of the campaign. Yeah, you needed those for how hard he was going to make the encounters.
Yep, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. I got my campaign mixed up.
That's
all good.
That I wasn't even in.
Innistrad was magical.
Yeah. Rael was awesome in that.
Actually, girl who wasn't here when we played those campaigns. Because I wasn't cool enough to be part of the group.
So item 6 is game rules. So let's talk about ideas for gaining advantage. So number 1 is inspiration, which, you know, is a part of the game. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go over 2 different ways here. I'm going to go through inspiration and I'm going to go through luck points. So the inspiration variety of gaining advantage would be that as per the normal rules, you can only have inspiration once. But if you gain inspiration a second time, you can immediately give it to another character. Inspiration is awarded at the beginning of a session. That's a house rule. And for completing a long rest, which is a house rule. But you would get it at the beginning of a session and for completing a long rest. Inspiration would also be awarded for rolling a 1 when you roll a d20. If you roll a 1, you get inspiration, another house rule. And it can be given to someone else immediately or sometime later. If you have it already and you roll a 1 on something and you want to give the 1 you just gained to somebody else or the 1 you already had, doesn't really matter. That's what you would do. And when using inspiration, we've usually used the rule where, like, if you roll a die, and then you're like, I want to use my inspiration, and then you roll the die, another die. That's the rule that we use. It's not actually as it's written in the player's handbook.
You have to say it first.
You have to say it first and then roll the dice, but we've always just said, it's fine, whatever. If you want to just use it after you roll the first die, then go ahead and roll a second die, and we're going to stick with that rule.
All right. I mean, I could... Just for a point of argument, I could see that both ways, because if you're going to be giving out, because one of the reasons we did it that way is because inspiration was so rare.
True.
But if we're all going to be starting off with inspiration every session.
Okay. I mean, I can see that as being an argument.
Or
to
every
say.
Time we orc hardcore.
Yeah. Right.
Like, it's a d20 roll of 1, right? Which that depends on the session. Some sessions you might do it 3 times, other sessions not at all, right?
Right.
It's variable. I like that. What was the 4th criteria?
So if you want to say that you have to declare it before you roll, since you'll get it more often, I'd be fine with doing it that way if everybody thinks that that's a good way to do it.
Oh, declaring before we make a roll that we're going to use.
I'm fine with ratcheting.
I'm okay with that. I thought we did that in the tomb anyway, didn't we? I thought in the tomb we largely said that people had to declare it before they rolled.
I don't remember.
I don't think we got inspiration in the tomb more than twice.
Occasionally.
I'd throw some out when somebody did something that made me laugh. But
I do like that though, because if we use these rules, you'll be getting it more often.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So then you'll have to declare.
Sure.
So
it's at the beginning of each session when we roll in that 1 and.
And after taking a long rest.
And those after 3. Taking a long rest.
I thought was there a 4th one or that was. I thought you listed something else off. I was trying to take notes on it.
Beginning of a session and a long rest, and when you roll a 1, and that's it.
Okay.
Rules lawyering. My lucky feat. Re-rolling my first 1 on an attack roll.
Yep.
Is that because I re-roll the 1, does that nullify the 1 and I don't get the inspiration? Or I rolled a 1, I get inspiration. Now let me re-roll that.
I mean, why penalize your race, right? That's what you chose.
Consider that not a
There's other features
one.
That your race doesn't get because of has
I,
that.
I mean, the racial. You're talking about the halfling racial feature.
Yeah.
Yes.
So basically, you would be. That racial feature allows you to basically not have to deal with rolling a 1.
Yes. Well,
I would say the feature makes it so that you're lucky enough that you didn't roll that 1. That 1 never happened.
Yeah. I mean, I don't. I feel like you wouldn't get inspiration for that.
Okay. I mean, that's fine. I just...
Because you're not being penalized for rolling a 1,
mm-hmm.
whereas I want it to be like, oh, you rolled a 1, that sucks. Here's inspiration.
Yeah.
But if you're like, oh, I rolled a 1, and then I re-rolled it, I'm not gonna reward you for rerolling your one.
Unless I roll another one.
If you roll another one, you can definitely get inspiration.
You roll a one, and then you roll another one.
I have earned that inspiration.
You have earned that bork. bork.
Actually, I think it's really hard to roll a one.
It is. Rolling a nat one is actually, as I found out as Janie, rolling a one through four is actually not as easy as it sounds.
Yeah, for your wild surge. Janie.
As a wild surge, yeah.
Yep.
It wasn't as often as we thought it would be.
I always thought it was funny that it was like you rolled the ones on initiative rolls, and then you get
I borked the initiative, and then I go the wild surge.
16. 17.
So let's talk about luck points. So my idea was that we'd probably use either inspiration with the rules that we just discussed, mm-hmm. or we would use luck points. So luck points are every time a character misses with an attack or fails a saving throw, they gain a luck point. Not rolling a one. Okay, if you make an attack roll and you miss, you get a luck point. Or if you make a saving throw and you don't succeed, you get a luck point. You can only hold up to 5 luck points. If you gain a sixth luck point, you roll a d4, and that's how many luck points you now have.
Mm.
So I think I prefer...
It encourages you to burn them, yes.
I prefer the inspiration.
No, wait.
Okay.
Continue.
I'm not done.
Okay. All right.
I love you. You can spend 1 luck point to get +1 to a d20 roll after you make the roll. And you can spend as many luck points as you want. You know, so if you roll a 12 and you want to spend 4 luck points to make it a 16, go for it. You can also spend 3 luck points to just re-roll a 20.
Okay.
So that is luck.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, luck would be... The luck rolls would be really useful for like the people that have dex-based builds where they're missing on everything except the 1 and 2.
Right. Well, and I was thinking about the fact that that system inherently kind of shorts the casters, which I'm not playing a caster, but just thinking broadly of the whole table. Mm-hmm. Although on the other hand, it's like if you're playing a caster and you're doing area effects, you probably don't need those extra points to buff things up 1 or 2 or 3 or 4, right? So,
casters aren't making as many attack rolls.
I'd be inclined to favor the inspiration system because it has broader and more creative benefits because you can use that on any type of roll, whereas the luck points you can only apply to very specific
things.
Luck
points can be added to any type of roll, too.
Doesn't really help to our casters.
To any d20 roll.
Yeah.
Any d20 roll.
But like...
That includes skills.
I would lean towards that if you can also use a luck point to decrease like an enemy saving throw. Otherwise, casters that have all these, you know, save things for saves.
Yeah,
don't get any benefit from that, from luck points.
So if you could like spend 3 luck points to give the creature -3 on their saving throw against it.
But also those casters aren't
lucky shot.
They're not going to be able to accrue luck points because a caster who's using largely save-based things, they aren't going to be missing on attacks, failing saving throws is very situational.
No, it's on a miss or fail of a saving throw.
Right, but that's them failing the saving throw, not the enemy that they're casting the spell on.
Right, but but there are lots of...
enemies that are going to be throwing saving throws at them.
I find that's situational.
Also, I mean, and people use cantrips all the time, like Elder's Blast, and they're making attack rolls, and if they miss with their Elder's Blast, they're getting luck points.
Yeah. I feel like the casters get shorted a bit, but I feel the inspiration is more of a holistic system.
I see what you're saying, Kate. And I kind of agree. I think the difference, like I said... Using luck points to decrease an enemy's saving throw against your thing would be the equivalent of adding 3 to an attack
roll. What's Greg's opinion?
Yeah.
And that kind of would kind of... They'd be... Yeah. That'd be about the same.
Cut, wash it out a little bit. Yeah, there's some difference.
I honestly don't really know.
You don't have an opinion one way or the other?
I think they're both equal in terms of what you might get out of them. Maybe...
I mean, do you see what the point we were saying about the casters?
Yes.
It's funky. It's a little bit different if you're a caster.
Yeah. Because I am going to, if I end up playing the bard, I'm going to be making a lot of casting. Almost all my spells are, I cast this, do they save against it?
Right.
I would have, if you guys decide to go with luck, I would have, I would allow what you described. I would allow you to give penalties to saving throws using luck.
I think that was how the sorcerer's ability to do that D4 lucky thing was at her, like, 15th level ability.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
She could both give her teammates a D4 plus or take away from an enemy's save. Yeah. I believe that's how it worked with Janie.
I guess the question with the bard is, like, are you innately in your playstyle going to be doing spells that are attack rolls or occasionally making attacks with your knives? Otherwise
he doesn't know that yet. He can't know that yet. That's future John's issue.
Basically, yes.
But that would be the challenge. Is if your particular style of play settles that you are doing those things, and short of when you fail a saving throw, you're not going to get the luck point.
I guess
can we give them to other players?
No, that's not part of the luck system.
Okay, because that would be the other thing that would kind of equalize, is if we did have the ability.
You can't give away your luck, honey. I didn't rub my luck off on you.
We do with inspiration.
My question would be
You can inspire somebody else, but you can't rub your luck off on someone else.
Well, sorry,
you can only do that in the movies.
I was going to say, my question would be this. In our style of play, which do you feel has more weight in terms of resources and or actual added advantage to the game?
I feel like in our style of play, luck points is going to cause us to do more meta shit. Because we figure out the AC quickly, we figure out the saving throws quickly, and we do the numbers, because we're all math people.
I'm not a math person.
But we figure it out, and she'll tell you.
Yeah.
Oh, you're too short.
Medicaid will be like, just add +3 to that, and you'll pass it.
No offense.
I think the inspiration system is more of a, you're not going to be sure if this is going to be helpful or not, but if you're feeling nervous about this role, it can help up your chances.
Yeah.
And with the inspiration system being more frequent, actually getting it, it's not going to be as, oh, wow, inspiration. I never get that.
I'm also leaning towards inspiration, A, for simplicity.
Sure.
It's using existing mechanics, and it doesn't end up with a whole bunch of weird edge cases.
Sure.
And B, it'll really help our rogue.
so that's two votes for inspiration.
I vote for inspiration.
Three votes for inspiration.
A lot of times I would never use my inspiration because I was afraid I wouldn't get it back ever again.
I gotcha.
So I would use it more with the knowing I'm going to get one at the beginning of each game.
And one addition, probably going to end up with one, maybe two additional backstabs per event, per session is not a huge deal.
Okay, so the majority of the people at the table want inspiration. Okay, so we will use inspiration, and because you get it more frequently, we'll say you have to declare it before you make the roll.
Before you roll.
I think that's fair.
Okay.
So it is a bit of a gamble as to whether it'll be helpful or not.
Right, because sometimes you roll one and a two, right?
That is the nature. If you're not gambling when you're playing D&D,
more than
you're not
one of us
D&D,
at
right.
this table has used advantage and rolled a one and a one. I'm looking at you, Chris.
In a really cool plot situation like that.
So, since we're choosing inspiration, I have gifts for all of you.
Oh.
So these are inspiration markers. For the listeners, these are wooden circular discs that have a finish on them, and they say inspiration, and they have like designs burned into them.
Dark finish.
And everybody gets to choose one, and they're going to basically put a 20-sided die in that circular piece of wood.
It's made to fit a D20.
It's made to fit a
D20. That's so cool. Can't fit my Megazord.
And
always have to find the problem.
And I have inspiration dice, although you don't need to use these. But I have red and black inspiration dice.
Clickety clack.
On the 20, they say yeah.
Yeah. And on the one, it says fuck. I'm gonna go with a black one. Or do we get one of each?
You just get to choose.
That goes red.
You get to choose black or red.
Fuck yeah.
Teeter.
Explicit.
I might buck the trend.
We have a warning on the website, man.
Explicit for Sarah.
Hi, it's me. I'm the problem.
I'm the problem sometimes.
Hi.
It's all right.
But more in a subtle way than an over-the-top way.
I'm the problem. It's me.
So you guys can use whatever die you want for that little inspiration. Disc, but I just thought those would be funny.
That is cool. I just rolled that right into
it. Everybody agrees.
Okay, so we're using inspiration, but you have to declare it before you roll it. Okay.
See, I can't even make that happen again. I rolled a dice and it went right in there.
Oh, I've rolled 2 sixes and a 4 with it so far. Yeah!
Yeah!
Yeah! 6, 6, 4, 20!
420.
Oh.
But that's okay. I mean, our custom races are basically a tree, getting stoned, and crystal.
Okay, so, counterspell.
I'm okay with that.
Continuing with the rules. Counterspell, casters. If you're playing a caster, you have to say the name of the spell and its level every time you cast it, regardless of whether or not you've got, like, an enemy wizard or something. You know, just say I'm casting a third level fireball. You know, first level, they just always save the level, so it just makes it easier in case counterspell is a thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, the opposing caster will say I'm doing a third level counterspell or a fourth level counterspell. You just got to say your spells with the level. Just makes it easier.
Then I can say I'm doing a fifth level counterspell to counterspell your counterspell.
Exactly. Yeah. The ready action cannot be taken outside of combat. That was just something I saw come up. I think I heard about it in a podcast or something. People are trying to ready something when there isn't a combat going on, but that's intended for to happen during combat. Okay, so we are back. We just took a little bit of a break, and we have a little six-month-old Sebastian with us at the table now.
Not little anymore.
So I had just gone over the ready action. And grappling, an opposed check is required to move a creature you are grappling. You can't just move them per the regular rules. You have to make an opposed strength check to move them. The spell Silvery Barbs is not allowed. Monks can only use Stunning Strike on one attack per round, and only when they take the attack action on their turn. Because of spells like Power Word Kill and Sleep, both of which reference hit points, this is sort of a question. Should the DM know how many hit points a character has? Are they above the table for online play? I mean, they are above the table when using D&D Beyond to run encounters. For example, if I'm running the encounter on D&D Beyond, which I don't do, but if I did, I'd know what your hit points were. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Like, if Power Word Kill says if you have 100 hit points or less, you know, then you die. And it's like, as the DM, I would know what your hit points were. And, you know, I don't want to cheese it. I don't want to be cheesy, but at the same time, like you all know what your character's hit points are. We don't like, mask that. Mm-hmm. If somebody says, how many hit points do you have? You can just say, I have 25 hit points left. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get the group's input on whether or not I, as the DM, or anybody who's the DM, should know what the character's hit points are. Because there are spells that say if they have this number of hit points, then this happens.
Yeah, and that's always been an interesting question just for DM metagaming in general. I mean, can a DM even metagame? That's an interesting question. Philosophical question. No, we don't have to get into it.
Philosophical John is philosophicaling.
Like, for instance, it was a similar question of counterspell, which you're going around by saying the person has to declare what the level of the spell is they're
correct,
saying.
Yes.
But previously, that didn't happen, and counterspell was always just kind of a gamble.
Right.
Like if I was going to counterspell the DM, I didn't know if I was going to be casting high enough or not.
So the question is, how much of a DM gamble? I mean, should it be the same? Should the DM be making the same gamble that the players are? On those kinds of situations.
I'm of the mindset that yes, because we don't know.
We don't know how many hit points the big bad has
left. Right. Like, yeah.
So unless you want to display how many hit points the enemies have, it's
So how does this? So like, if you guys are running encounters that need to be on,
that's an interesting practical question.
And you can see what the character's hit points are, and you have power or kill, you know, ready to go. You know exactly who you can kill.
But we, as the players, can't run the encounter in D&D Beyond.
Understood. But like, basically, it sounds like if you're running D&D Beyond, the DM has the ability to metagame and be like, I'm going to kill this character. And I don't like that idea. Yeah.
I mean, this was relevant specifically to Matisse in the last campaign, in the final encounter. Chris cast that spell knowing it would work.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's...
But I was tracking people's hit points.
You were. Yeah, but again, it's kind of... We don't have that same tool as players, so it's kind of... It is a tricky gray area. That's the only point I'm making.
Yeah, and I'm just asking for people's thoughts. I'm like, what do you think?
I think that that's something that D&D Beyond might want to look into fixing.
I don't know. I mean,
because that's something that a DM should think about as a ethical issue.
Yeah.
I mean, devil's advocate, though, the DM should be allowed to metagame in order to move the story forward and to.
No, I mean, that's true, because they are the puppet master.
Right. So,
master of puppets.
That then comes down to a question of how much do we trust the DM.
And knowing what our levels are, they would normally have a general idea of where our hit points are anyway.
And in our case, we don't trust the DM at all, so we need to do something about that.
Yeah, it's difficult because like one of the steps that a lot of people take before they run is they'll review the characters.
We do generally as a group, every time we level up, update what our hit points are, what our ACs are, and where our passive insights are for you, so that you know where we're starting at every encounter, generally. So
it sounds like you all agree that basically like D&D Beyond, I don't use D&D Beyond, so I guess that's not much of an issue for this campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And I do hand around a sheet to everybody, for the sake of the listeners, that has them put their hit points and their armor class and their passive perceptions on it. So I will continue to basically, you know, like I'm not going to ask you how many hit points do you have left. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do that. You know, I might have a general idea because I have
the
sheet.
At the table, sometimes we do go on a scale of 1 to 34. I'm at about a 12.
Well, sure.
We choose to share that, though. That's our choice.
And we declare when we're bloody.
We do.
I would think, though, that all of us here have not been very secretive about what our hit points are.
It is relevant for some things, too. Like, Chris has played bad guys where it's like, if you're bloody, it gives them different abilities. If you're at quarter hit points, it gives them different abilities. So sometimes as a DM, he does need that tool to play characters with more depth of flavor, right? Yeah.
I don't... I mean, you can maybe remind me, but I don't remember ever having anything that specific.
Cops had that ability. If you were bloody...
If you're bloody,
you could
take
a quarter of your hit points with the if he made you fail a save.
Yeah. Or even just... Blood. Yeah, or even just casting a simple spell like sleep, which is going to be on my repertoire.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so we're going to go with the idea that the DM is not supposed to know the exact number of hit points that you have, and that he'll have to guess, just like you guys have to guess if the monsters have a certain number of hit points.
Yeah. It could be an interesting play as long as it doesn't become too much DM versus players.
No, which I don't want to do. I really don't want to have that happen. And so we'll just leave it the way it is to let people guess.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah brought up the idea of the counterspell. I mean, are people okay with doing it above board like I suggested? Or would you rather change it back to guessing?
I'm okay with it being above the board.
Okay.
Although, I mean, I don't think it'll be much of an issue in this campaign.
Yeah, I mean, I think the official rules are you can make an arcana check to get that information, but that's something that tends to slow down the game.
There is something that came up, I think, in Tasha's Cauldron of Everything or something, where they gave rules where you could use your reaction to make an arcana check to tell what level the spell was, and I'm just like, that just adds more, more
just
stuff.
Then you need a second caster, mechanics. So someone make the check and someone cast the spell, right?
Which is why I just said, why don't we just say the level of the spell?
I think I have no problem in like meta level envisioning that like you can generally tell if you're a magician and someone else is casting what strength they are preparing to cast with, right?
Yeah.
Like that to me.
So are we?
I would think on a general basis as a caster versus caster, you can tell
they're in a battle,
a lot of mana, right?
How strong they are, yeah. and where they're at in the middle, in the midst of a throwdown. Yeah. Like,
okay. So we will keep the counterspell rule the way it is, and we will say that the hit points are not above board.
Right.
Okay. Sounds good.
And as for when we're calling you to each other for like somebody tells me I need healing, it'll just be up to you to tell me I need healing.
Sure. Sure.
And try not to be too greedy with that. Oh no, I got a scratch, I need healing. Yeah.
Okay. I don't think anyone's
likewise,
like that.
If we choose to say something out loud about our hip points are bloody, then obviously there's a common sense. Like everybody at the table is going to be able to glean what that means. Right. If you tell the DM, I only have five. If you tell your other ally, you have five hip points. The DM deserves to have that knowledge too.
Yeah, sure.
You just saw it.
So.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds good.
Sounded goodeth.
So. Let's discuss item 7, which is table rules. So, dice that are dropped by accident or that roll off the table or out of a dice tray must be rerolled. Cell phone usage, which this is all pretty standard stuff for us, is not allowed except if you have something serious that you need to attend to during the session. Just let me know. And so I know
what I have no idea what you're talking about.
She says as she holds her cell phone up to her
I'm
chest.
I'm taking a photo. Or I was.
So hold on. So if you want
that's
to,
relevant.
If you have something serious, just let me know so that I know you're tracking it. If you want to secretly communicate something to somebody at the table without saying it to them, that's relevant to the adventure, that's fine. If you want to take pictures, which I love Sarah because she takes pictures for our Instagram. So that is perfectly fine as well. For all the reasons, please don't be on your phone.
Common sense. Yep.
Common sense stuff.
Just courtesy. Yep.
If you're, please only eat snacks during our break. If you are super behind on food and you're desperate for snacks, please don't eat like potato chips or have like packages that crackle and make all kinds of noise when you open them. But in general, if you could please try to
make sure to bring all of my crackly snacks.
If you could please try to keep snacking to before we start and then during the break and then after, that would be great. That's it for table rules. There's Sebastian.
I would like to request that we do not bring babies to the table.
I would like to request that we bring more babies to the table.
Oh,
no. I cast baby.
Are you offering?
I think there are babies at the table. Or no.
Eyebrows. John.
Okay, so item number 8 is playing a person down, which, this hasn't been a huge issue, but like, if someone is going to miss a session, the baby burps. If someone is going to miss a session and a reschedule is not possible, we will play a person down on our usual Sunday, and I may invite a guest player to kind of sit in for that session. And if we reschedule a session and someone can't make the reschedule, then we'll just play on the reschedule day a person down, possibly with a guest player.
Yeah, I mean, if something happens on the day of, you're probably not going to get a guest player.
But. Probably not, right. But yeah, but if somebody, if we reschedule and someone still cancels at the last minute because life happens, then I'd still like to be able to play.
What do you mean? D&D is life.
Hell yeah.
So item number 9 is safety tools. And a lot of Session Zeros use safety tools as a way to make sure everyone will feel safe and comfortable playing in a particular adventure or campaign. Safety tools often include discussions about things like, not having torture in a campaign or sexual assault. Or any variety of other sensitive topics.
I don't feel safe right now. Kate is trying to look at my notes.
Oftentimes, game masters will even use one of many available checklists. Because we are all good friends who have been gaming together for years, I haven't really felt the need to do this, but it couldn't hurt, and I would like the listeners to gain the benefit of knowing what safety tools for a Session Zero are. They're mostly for running games online with people you don't know. Or when starting a new group, you want to make sure that people are aware of what's going on. And
you never know what's going to trigger something.
Yeah, you know. We're going to discuss safety tools with regards to something called lines and veils, which is another. It's a very common theme with safety tools. So lines are things that are not crossed, and veils are things that you might hear about, but you don't experience them directly. So lines for this campaign that will not be crossed are as follows. No player versus player combat or inter-party betrayal. That's just something from the DM. But there won't be any violence toward children. There won't be any sort of themes of sexual assault or animal cruelty or torture. Veils would be something like torture could be veiled off screen, meaning, you know, somebody might talk about somebody having been tortured, or you may find a non-player character who looks like they've suffered from being tortured or something like that. But I don't want to do anything that's going to make anyone really uncomfortable. If at any time any of you feel uncomfortable with anything, I want you to let me know. And I'm instituting a rule that is just sort of a formalizing of the idea of basically saying, hey, I'm not comfortable with this, which is the idea of pause for a minute. So if something triggers you, you know, if I talk about a house fire and you're in a house fire and you're like, oh my God, you can just say, can we pause for a minute? And choose to talk about a game, talk out of game about a topic or a concern. It could be something as simple as the adventure has a lot of bloody, like, body horror, and someone's like, no, I'm not really into this right now, it's making me uncomfortable. You can just ask to pause for a minute. If something in the adventure reminds someone of something really sad, you know, particularly if like something just happened in your life and something comes up that's similar and you're getting emotional, just please ask us to pause for a minute. It can be used if there's tension, like if there's any kind of tension between players or the DM and a player and things are getting kind of heated, we can be like, all right, let's pause for a minute.
That never happens between you and I.
No, never.
Sarah, one of us has been on the edge and weirdness happens because one of the three.
It's life. It's life, man. Yeah. It happens. Yeah.
Makes for the best dramatic role play.
I'm just formalizing this idea of pause for a minute.
Okay, so that's
absolutely
our safe word.
That's kind of the safe word.
I'm going to write that on the top of my notepad.
Pause for station identification.
Like on the spine.
So the very last thing that I have here is I just have a topic that says further development, which is just me asking for general ideas and suggestions. I mean, if there's anything about what we already talked about that you want to go over again, if there's any ideas that you just want to throw at me, like, this is just open discussion right now.
Is it only ideas I'm allowed to throw right now?
Yes.
Darn.
Unless you want to throw chocolate donuts, that would be okay.
The one chocolate donut we had is already been
consumed.
There's
a whole chocolate donut. I'm going to get chocolate frosted, so if you're craving it.
No.
Do you
want
to throw babies at me?
I'm fine. Sarah's going to take a baby.
He's starting to push into standing.
That was just his foot. It's all good. Is there anything anybody else wants to discuss that we talked about or that we didn't talk about? Anything at all? Any questions? Character creation, I figure, might be a topic. Any questions at all about anything?
As we go through and come up with our character concepts, I think most of us kind of have an idea roughly. Are you planning to like institute like NPCs to fill in holes in like party formation or anything like that? Or
it sort of depends on what your party dynamic is. If you have no healers, I will find a way to give you some kind of healing. That's the main thing in my brain, where if I'm running a campaign and the party has no healing of any kind, I'll usually try to supplement that in some way. Outside of that, I will probably not have a dedicated party NPC. I mean, I may change my mind.
Can Sebastian run the NPC?
Sebastian could maybe run the NPC.
Healer baby.
Healer bot.
Right now, John, I'm not planning on having a dead. Whoa.
Rage me.
I'm not planning on having a dedicated NPC in the party.
Okay.
But if a hole needs to be filled in some way, I may reconsider that idea.
Yeah. Okay. I think right now we're shaping up for one bard, so like a partial healer in the party.
Yeah, so no GH 2024.
No golem of healings. I could give magic items. I could, you know, we had the, what was it, in Points of Light, we had the light bearers, and they could like give temporary hit points to each other and stuff like that. I mean, I'll look at the party composition and then decide from there. And, you know, I like running NPCs sometimes, but it's also a lot more work.
It is, yeah.
So we'll kind of see how it goes. Sarah's really liking baby time right now.
My nose is being discovered.
So, all right, so people are good as far as everything goes with regards to all the random subjects that I brought up?
Yeah.
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, my biggest question is, you know, what level were we starting off with, stuff like that?
Yeah, first level, first level max hit points, you know, point buy for abilities.
Yep.
Okay, so why don't we do just a tiny little bit of something to kind of kick off the adventure part of the campaign. So, as our adventure begins, the date is Chargaroth 16th, 3252 AD. Each of your characters was born with a birthmark reminiscent of a dragon's claw. From the time you reached adulthood, you've had recurring dreams that are difficult to describe. These dreams are blurry with flashes of teeth, claws, and wings. You have always felt as though you were destined for a greater purpose. To that end, and possibly for other reasons, you decided to become an adventurer. You are in search of your destiny, and you will do whatever it takes to find out exactly what that destiny is and how to bring it to fruition. So you all live on the island continent of Iador, in the capital city of Shikar. You do not know each other. Individually, you each take on a variety of small jobs to make money. If you guys want to say you know each other, we can always work on that. These jobs include such things as escort duty, deliveries to dangerous areas, and perhaps clearing a graveyard of a few shambling undead. Having an adventuring party would allow for better paying jobs, and your hope is to find like-minded individuals to seek out adventure with. There are many job boards in the city that offer opportunities for such adventurers, but so far, you've done things on your own. Yesterday, when you returned to your living quarters, you found a note with a bag of 100 gold pieces. The note read, "Meet behind Barton's provisions at midnight." Where the signature would be, there was a symbol that matched your birthmark. It is now midnight. You all arrived behind Barton's provisions to see a door with a parchment on it bearing the symbol of the birthmark. You are now in the back room of Barton's provisions. The room is 20 foot square with a table and chairs. There is a door in the north wall. A human male enters the room and closes the door behind him. He is about 6 feet tall, thin, maybe in his early 40s, wearing common clothes. He has short brown hair with gray at the temples and a day's worth of stubble on his face. He seems a little worried. With a cautious look on his face, he takes a look at all of you and says, "I am Barton. Please show me the birthmark."
"A little private."
It's very important.
"How do you know of this?"
"All will be explained very shortly, but you have to show me the birthmark."
Alright. I look around at these strange people around me that I might have seen on the street every now and then.
You might have seen them, yeah.
Or at the, you know, random at the places job boards, that adventurers yep. go, but yep. I'm like, "What do you mean?
I'm halfway tempted to just drop trial."
My right character now. Just kind of like.
You could say your birthmark is on your butt if you want.
Giant 7 foot tall female tree, right? And she's like, "Suit yourself," and just like turns her shoulder, and on the back of her shoulder, there's the claw mark. So for those who are feeling hesitant, you can now see that she has something that matches what we all saw.
I do
saw.
Drop my trousers.
What did you say the birthmark looks like again? I'm sorry.
It is a dragon claw birthmark.
Okay, like the dragon hands claws?
Correct,
okay.
Yeah.
Correct.
It's on my leg.
Just looks like a single claw.
You drop trout on your leg?
My thigh.
Okay, upper so thigh. Do you keep your underwear on?
Yes.
Okay.
This is a PG-13 rated show.
Is it?
Explicit.
No, we are explicit.
Explicit.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. I think it's rated M for my.
Well, then I let your imagination go.
Impressionable toddlers here. We're a little more.
It's rated S for Sarah.
Seriously? Rated S for it is seriously, Sarah?
The birthmark is in a strategic place. Whether or not I have undergarments on, it does not matter.
Okay.
Nice. We broke Sarah.
I lift up my shirt and it's on my ribcage.
Okay. Stole my idea. Okay.
Yours could be on your ribcage too. I wasn't aware that anybody else had this.
I will explain everything in just a moment. Can you please show me your birthmark? He motions to you, John. To your character.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Okay, and yeah, and mine will be on my upper arm.
Okay. Barton says,
I caved.
Thank you. Thank you. I needed to be certain you were the right individuals. I need your help. He opens the door behind him and whispers the name Ophelia. A human woman, perhaps 18 to 20 years old, comes into the room. She has long brown hair and is wearing common clothes. Barton says, the rule of the Council of Scales must end. They must not be allowed to oppress Iodor any longer. My daughter Ophelia is the key. You must help her. You must help us. You must help all of Iodor. He turns to his daughter and says, show them. She pulls her hair behind her shoulders. Clearly visible on her neck is the dragon claw birthmark. And that's where we'll end right now. So.
Okay.
Ah. We'll pick up there with the first full-length adventure next time that we play.
Nice.
Wow.
Okay. I wonder if you can send us that text, because I'll probably need to use that when I'm writing my backstory.
Yeah, sure. I can do that. I can email it to you guys or put it on Google Drive or something.
Okay.
Google Drive.
And also to remind me that I've got 100 gold that I get.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, thanks for reminding me. I forgot to write that down.
Oh, okay.
100 gold.
100 gold.
Shopping.
100 gold.
Okay, so we went through session zero. We did a little tiny itty bitty adventure there.
The hook.
So let's say goodnight to the listeners.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us a review anywhere this podcast can be found. Our social media links, plus additional content, can be found on our website at knightsofroleplay.com. Please tell your friends about Knights of Roleplay, an adventuring podcast, and spread the word through social media. Your help and support are greatly appreciated.